I didn't receive any suggestions, so I'll just follow the plan that I laid out last lecture. So what I'd like to talk about today are E-infinity ring spectra and how you can glue them together to make things like schemes in analogy with the way you glue ordinary commutative rings together to make ordinary schemes. So first let me talk about E-infinity ring spectra. So I'm not going to give a definition, but I want to give an idea of how you might go about giving a definition and tell you a couple of ways that you can think about what an E-infinity ring spectrum is. So the first point of view is that an E-infinity ring spectrum is a cohomology theory with a good multiplicative structure. And an example that I'd like to talk about is complex K-theory. So let me remind you, if X is a nice space, say a finite CW complex, the complex K-theory of X is defined to be, well, first you take complex vector bundles over X, and then you mod out by isomorphisms. So you take isomorphism classes, and what you get has the structure of a semigroup where the addition is given by direct sums of complex vector bundles. And then you're supposed to form the growth and degroup of that by formally adjoining inverses. So this is an interesting invariant of topological spaces X. Now, it has more structure than just the structure of an abelian group. This is actually a commutative ring for all X. The ring structure, well, the addition is roughly given by sums of complex vector bundles, and the multiplication is given by tensor product of complex vector bundles. So this is a cohomology theory which takes spaces as input and outputs rings. And you would like to say that in some sense, these ring structures are coming about because K-theory itself has the structure of a commutative ring. And the language, a good language for making this precise, is the language of E-infinity ring spectra. K-theory is representable by an E-infinity ring spectrum. So now let me say a few words about what that means in more precise terms. So K-theory is a cohomology theory. In particular, it's representable. The K-theory of a space X can be identified with homotopy classes of maps from X into a classifying space for K-theory, which has the homotopy type of Z cross BU. And now, multiplication, addition and multiplication on K brackets X, well, by abstract nonsense, any sorts of operations that you have on a representable functor come from operations that you have on the representing object for this functor. So this addition and multiplication are represented by some sort of addition and multiplication maps, or let me give this space a name, this Z cross BU. How about Y? Addition is represented by some map from Y cross Y into Y, and multiplication is represented by some map from Y cross Y into Y. And moreover, because these operations on K-theory equip the K-theory with the structure of a commutative ring, these operations on the representing space have to satisfy the ring axioms, at least in the homotopy category. So plus and times satisfy ring axioms up to homotopy. So let me just give maybe a sample what one of the ring axioms says. One of the ring axioms is that multiplication is associative. So what does that say? So let's call this map M for multiplication. So the threefold product of Y can be parsed in two different ways. You can first multiply the second two coordinates, or you can first multiply the first two coordinates, and then you can multiply what's left. And this diagram is supposed to commute. It's not supposed to depend on where you put the parentheses. Now, we only know that this is true in the homotopy category, so what we really know is that there's some homotopy which makes this diagram homotopy commutative. A homotopy between two maps that we can write down from Y cross Y cross Y into Y. Now, where does the associative law on K-theory come from? So, associativity in K brackets X comes from the fact that tensor product of complex vector bundles is an associative operation up to natural isomorphism. So it comes from natural isomorphisms, say E1, tensor E2, tensor E3, to E1, tensor E2, tensor E3. Now, knowing that this diagram commutes up to homotopy, well, that tells you that multiplication on K brackets X is associative. We would know that multiplication on K brackets X was associative if we just knew that there was some isomorphism between these two tensor products. But we actually have a little bit more in practice. There's a canonical isomorphism in the world of complex vector bundles between these two tensor products. And the upshot of this is that this, we don't just know that there exists a homotopy here, but there's actually a canonical choice for this homotopy, at least a canonical choice up to homotopy. And the particular homotopy that we choose might satisfy some coherence conditions or higher identities. So, for example, if you're just talking about an ordinary commutative ring, you have objects and you just ask whether or not they're equal, and there's no further questions that you can ask. But if you're working in a category, like the category of complex vector bundles, you don't write down an equality between these two tensor products, you write down an isomorphism. And then you have questions that you can ask about this isomorphism. So, for example, you can ask whether or not it satisfies McLean's pentagon identity. So let me just write that down. If you have four objects, well, you can imagine moving the parentheses around in various ways. There are five isomorphisms that you can write down here using that associativity constraint, and you obtain a diagram in the category of complex vector bundles. And for the natural isomorphisms between tensor products that you write down, this diagram commutes. So this translates, if you take that isomorphism there and use it to write down, say, an explicit homotopy here, H, well, the commutativity of this diagram buys you certain conditions that are satisfied by this homotopy H. If there's some analogous picture that you could write down with four copies of Y here instead of three, and a sort of cubical diagram, I'm not going to draw it, but maybe you could imagine what it would look like, and you would have some sort of higher dimensional version of the condition that something commutes up to homotopy. So just knowing that there was an isomorphism would tell us that we had a ring object in the homotopy category, but the existence of a canonical isomorphism and various conditions that are satisfied by that canonical isomorphism buys us a lot more structure. So this is, you can informally say it, this space Y, it doesn't just have the structure of a ring object in the homotopy category, it has the structure of a ring object up to coherent homotopy. All of the ring axioms hold up to homotopy, but those homotopies are specified and satisfy certain coherence conditions of their own. So that is, roughly speaking, what an E-infinity ring spectrum is. Now, I'm oversimplifying a little bit. There's an E-infinity ring spectrum. Well, roughly speaking, you can think of it as the space Y that represents the cohomology theory. But that's an oversimplification because it's not a space, but a spectrum. A cohomology theory is not encoded by a single space, because when you specify a cohomology theory, you don't just have a single functor to abelian groups, but you have several. So remember, a cohomology theory, A, is a sequence of functors, A sub n, from spaces to abelian groups. And each of these spaces, say, each of these functors turns out to be representable. A sub n of x is homotopy classes of maps from x into some representing space, which I'll call y sub n. Now, these spaces are not supposed to be completely independent of one another. Because these functors, A sub n, are supposed to be related. If you have a pointed space, if x is a pointed space, and you compute the cohomology of, in degree n, of x relative to its base point, this is supposed to be isomorphic to the n plus first cohomology of the suspension of x relative to its base point. And what is this telling you? If you translate this, this is telling you that each of these spaces, y sub n, should be equivalent to the loop space of the next. So that is, these y sub n form a spectrum. And now, before I was only talking about y0, and I was saying y0 has the structure of a ring object in the homotopy category. Well, now, if we want to say the whole cohomology theory has a good multiplicative structure, then we should elaborate on that a little bit. We have multiplication maps yn cross ym into yn plus m. And those are reflecting the fact that these a sub n should have, these functors a sub n should assemble into a graded ring. That is, there's a map from a sub n of x tensor a sub m of x into a sub n plus m of x. Okay, so in very rough terms, an E-infinity ring spectrum, well, it's a spectrum, it's a sequence of spaces, each of which is the loop space of the next, and it's equipped with some sort of a multiplicative structure, multiplication maps. It would probably be better to write the smash product here, that is, to build into this notion the idea that the base points of these spaces are the identities for the multiplication. And these multiplication maps are supposed to satisfy some sort of commutative and associative laws up to coherent homotopy. So up to coherent homotopy takes some work to make precise, and there are various ways of making it precise. I'm not going to talk about them, but just as a rough approximation, you can, through this notion, you can sort of ignore all of these spaces except for the zeroth space and imagine that the zeroth space just has the structure of a commutative ring. Okay, so now, how do you think about an E-infinity ring spectrum? What are the important things to keep in mind when you're working with them? So let A be an E-infinity ring spectrum. And A has homotopy groups. Pi n of A, and these homotopy groups are in general defined for all n in Z. As a spectrum has homotopy groups both in positive and negative degrees, if you imagine that A is, this cohomology theory A is determined by these spaces Y sub n, well, pi n of A, well, first of all, you can interpret that as the minus nth cohomology group of a point if you think of A as a cohomology theory, or if you think of A as a sequence of spaces, Y sub n, then this is pi n plus k of Y sub k, provided that k is sufficiently large. That is, even if n is negative, for sufficiently large k, this expression is well defined, and the condition that each of these spaces be loop space of the next tells us that this expression here is independent of k for k large enough. But in particular, these, well, if n is greater than or equal to 0, pi n of A just means pi n of the zeroth space. So in ordinary homotopy groups, the ones that live in non-negative degrees are just the homotopy groups of a space Y. Now, ordinarily, the homotopy groups of a space are actually only groups for n positive, and they're actually only abelian for n greater than 1. But in this case, we're dealing with a space that has the structure of a commutative ring, at least up to homotopy, and this puts a commutative ring structure, say, on pi naught. So pi naught of A, this is pi naught of Y0. This has the structure of a commutative ring. Coming from the fact that Y0 has the structure of a commutative ring in the homotopy category. And more generally, every pi, well, pi star of A, all the homotopy groups taken together,
this has the structure of a graded commutative ring. Again, coming from the multiplication maps on these. Where did it go? So graded commutative here, the words graded and commutative go together. It means that when you want to commute two elements, say two elements which are homogeneous, they commute unless they both have odd degree, in which case they anti-commute. So we're not going to actually need to know this fact, I think, at all in this course, but we will need to know a consequence of this fact, which is that each of these homotopy groups has the structure of a pi 0 of A module. Okay, so now let me just introduce a bit of terminology. We will use later on, an E infinity ring A is connective if pi n of A is 0 for n less than 0. In other words, if it has no homotopy groups only in non-negative degrees. So, in this case, normally passing to the zero space loses information, because once you've forgotten about those deloopings of Y0, you can no longer extract the homotopy groups of A in negative degrees. But if A has no homotopy groups in negative degrees, then it's not so bad to really think of the E infinity ring spectrum A as determined by this space Y0. So, these are roughly the... Here, the dictionary, thinking of an E infinity ring spectrum as a space with a ring structure, here, that's not a bad thing to do. We'll say that A is discrete if pi n of A is 0 for n not equal to 0. So maybe discrete might be the wrong word here. If we think of A as a space with a ring structure, what I'm saying is that the higher homotopy groups of that space vanish, so that space is weakly homotopy equivalent to a discrete space, the discrete space that I would just get by collapsing all of its connected components. And in this case, what we get is really just the ordinary commutative algebra. That is, discrete E infinity rings. The theory of discrete E infinity rings is really equivalent to the theory of ordinary commutative rings. So let me say a few more words about what I mean by this. So, of course, this whole story is taking place in the world of homotopy theory. So, in some sense, we don't care too much about the actual topological spaces that we're working with. We only care about their homotopy types. So, a map F from A to B of E infinity rings is a equivalence or a weak equivalence if it induces isomorphisms from pi n of A to pi n of B for all that. At any time we have an equivalence of E infinity ring spectra, we should really think of it as just as good as an isomorphism. In this case, A and B are really the same object.
So if we have a discrete in the sense of these non-zero homotopy groups vanishing, it's equivalent to something which is actually discrete. That is, if I have, say, a topological space and its higher homotopy groups vanish, and then I were to take that topological space and collapse all of its connected components, well, then I would actually get a discrete space which was weakly homotopy equivalent to the original one. Okay. So, the last thing that I want to say about E-infinity ring spectra is that they're really homotopy theoretic or higher categorical objects. So, E-infinity ring spectra form an infinity category. So, I'll be a little bit more precise about this in the next lecture, but what that means roughly is that if A and B are E-infinity rings, then you have a space of maps on AB. Because of course, you can talk about, say, actual maps from A to B, but you also have a notion of homotopies between maps from A to B, and homotopies between those homotopies. So, this is going to be important in just a minute, as we'll see. Okay, so we have this notion of an E-infinity ring spectra, and it's closely related to the classical theory of commutative rings. In particular, any E-infinity ring spectrum determines an ordinary commutative ring by taking pi naught. The difference between an E-infinity ring spectrum and pi naught is that the E-infinity ring spectrum also has some other homotopy groups. And those other homotopy groups, together with the way that they're all bundled up into a spectrum, well, that's carrying some interesting information, but for today, at least, I want to take the point of view that really the most interesting information is contained in pi naught, and all that other stuff is somehow secondary. All right, so now what I'd like to talk about is doing algebraic geometry with these objects. So let me start by writing down one of the basic definitions in algebraic geometry, classical algebraic geometry. So remind you, a scheme is a topological space X, a sheaf OX of commutative rings. This is a sheaf on X, such that the pair XOX is locally isomorphic to spec A, O spec A, where A is a commutative ring. So what I would like to do is adapt this definition, replacing commutative ring by E-infinity ring spectrum everywhere. So we'll change this definition ever so slightly. A derived scheme is going to be a topological space X, a sheaf OX. Well, it's no longer going to be a sheaf of commutative rings. It's now going to be a sheaf of E-infinity rings. Such that the pair XOX
Well, it's locally equivalent to spec A, O spec A, but A is no longer an ordinary commutative ring, but it's now an E infinity ring. Okay, so there are lots of things that I need to explain in order for this to be a good definition. So the first, well, I've said something about what an E infinity ring is. Now, what does it mean to have a sheaf of E infinity rings? Well, this is maybe a slightly subtle point. It's related to, there's some subtleties here related to the fact that I said E infinity ring spectra should really be regarded as forming an infinity category rather than an ordinary category. So there are various definitions for E infinity ring spectra. One approach to giving the definition is to write down a model category. And, or, you know, some sort of ordinary category consisting of objects which represent E infinity ring spectra. And if you were to do that, by sheaf of E infinity ring spectra, I don't mean a sheaf with values in that ordinary category. So I'll come back to this point in a second. But the other thing I need to explain is what I mean by spec A, where A is an E infinity ring spectra. Okay, so let me, doesn't matter what order we do it in, let's start with the notion of a sheaf. So let X be a space, and here I'm thinking of X as a real topological space. It's not a homotopy type. It's something that we're going to have sheaves on. Now, a sheaf of sets on X is a pre-sheaf of sets on X, satisfying descent. So descent means that if I have a bunch of sections defined on some open covering of some open subset of X, and those sections agree on overlaps, then I can glue them together to obtain a unique section over that open covering. So for example, so let me give this pre-sheaf a name, call the pre-sheaf F. So the F is something that I can evaluate on open subsets of X. So if I had two open subsets, U and V, then I can make two other open subsets by taking their union and their intersection, and I have a bunch of maps because F is a pre-sheaf. And now what I would be saying is, giving a section over U union V is the same thing as giving a section over U a section over V such that they agree over in the overlap. In other words, this diagram should be a pullback in the category of sets. Now, in the infinity categorical setting, we require instead that this is a homotopy pullback. So let me say some words about what that means. So to be a pullback, say in ordinary category theory, you would require that, let me just say it in words. If you have some set, then giving a map from that set into this should be the same thing as giving a map to this and a map to this, which induce the same map into this. Now,
in the infinity categorical setting, if we're working with something like a topological category, it's not natural to demand that maps be equal. Instead, you should demand that maps be homotopic to one another. So the homotopy pullback is something which has a similar universal property. Now, giving a map into the homotopy pullback should be the same thing as giving a map into F of U, giving a map into F of V, and giving a homotopy between the two induced maps to F of U union V. So this is, in general, very different from the ordinary pullback if we're working in a setting where the ordinary pullback makes sense, and it's not the same thing as a pullback in the homotopy category, because we're not just demanding that these two maps into F of U and F of B be homotopic, we're actually taking that homotopy as part of the data. So, a sheaf of the infinity rings is going to be a pre-sheaf of E infinity rings, which satisfies this sort of a descent condition. Now, of course, I've only written down a very simple case of the descent condition, namely where I'm covering an open set by two open pieces of it. Of course, there are more general instances of this sort of descent condition where I use more open pieces, but actually, for the kinds of topological spaces that we're going to be dealing with, this is essentially the only condition that you need to impose in order to have a sheaf for topological spaces like spectra of Noetherian rings. Maybe you should, well, and you should impose the condition. That's not quite true. There's also the condition that F of the empty set, this should be contractible. Final. Okay. But that's what we're going to mean by a sheaf of E infinity ring spectra. Okay, now I will have to tell you what I mean by spec A, where A is an E infinity ring spectra. So let A be an E infinity ring. So by spec A, I'm going to mean something very simple. I'm just going to mean spec of pi naught of A. I'm going to take seriously this idea, which I mentioned earlier, where I should think of pi naught of A as the most important invariant of A. Those other homotopy groups that A has, well, they're going to play a role, but they're not going to play a role in determining the topology of our derived schemes. So let me just remind you, spec pi naught of A, this is the set of prime ideals, P, contained in pi naught of A. And I'm going to give it the usual Zariski topology, where this has a basis of open sets consisting of U sub F, the set of prime ideals P, which do not contain a given element F. Here, F is allowed to be any element in pi naught of A. Okay, so spec pi naught of A is something very simple. What about O spec A? So this is going to be something a little bit more complicated, because rather than being a sheaf of ordinary commutative rings, it's going to be a sheaf of E infinity rings. So O spec A, well, if this was ordinary commutative algebra, if I was building ordinary schemes, it's going to be a sheaf, it's going to be determined by its values on a basis for the topology of spec A. So I need to say what it is on these basic open sets U sub F, and ordinarily I would say this should be A adjoin F inverse. And I'm also going to say this in the world of E infinity ring spectra. So now I should say, what do I mean by A adjoin F inverse in this world of E infinity rings? So,
So let A be an E infinity ring, and let F be an element in pi naught of A. What should A adjoint F inverse be? So there's two possible answers. So answer number one is that A adjoint F inverse should be something with a certain universal property. That is, we should take A and we should invert F. So answer number one, we want to look for a map, say phi, from A to A adjoint F inverse, such that for all B, the infinity rings, composition with phi will induce a map from Homs from A adjoint F inverse into B into Homs from A into B. And we want to demand that this is a homotopy equivalence onto the subspace of Hom AB, namely inside Hom AB. Every map from A to B determines a map from pi naught of A to pi naught of B. And in particular, F has some image in pi naught of B under that map. So we can pass to a subspace consisting of those maps from A to B which carry F to an invertible element in pi naught of B onto, let's say, the subspace such that F goes to something invertible. That's going to be a union of path components in this space Hom AB. And we would like to require A adjoint F inverse to have a universal property. Giving a map from A adjoint F inverse into B is the same thing as giving a map from A into B such that F becomes invertible. So by the same thing, well, that's all taken in this sort of infinity categorical sense that I've been talking about. We have mapping spaces, and we require not that this is an isomorphism of spaces, but instead that it's a homotopy equivalence of spaces. Okay, so that's answer number one, is that A adjoint F inverse should be something with this universal property. I'll claim there exists phi from A to A adjoint F inverse with that property. And note, by abstract nonsense, this determines A adjoint F inverse and phi up to up to equivalence, but even more precisely than that, up to, you might say, a contractible space of choices. Okay. Another answer that we might give to the question, what should A adjoint F inverse be? Well, I told you that the most important invariant of an E infinity ring spectrum are its homotopy groups. So by A adjoint F inverse, you might look for something whose homotopy groups look like the homotopy groups of A with F inverted. So answer number two, look for a map from, say, A to V from A to A adjoint F inverse such that pi star of A adjoint F inverse then gets identified with pi star of A, adjoin an inverse to F. So now here, I'm not giving a universal mapping property of A adjoin F inverse. I'm only describing what its homotopy groups look like. But so it's not clear that this uniquely determines A adjoin F inverse. This is just a property that a map out of A might have. But it turns out that this, in fact, does pin down A adjoin F inverse because answer number one and answer number two are equivalent to one another. That is, it's not something that is completely obvious. It requires some proof. I'm not going to give the proof, at least not today. But it gives you some idea of, well, what these things mean and how you might work with them, hopefully. Okay, so now we have the definition of a derived scheme. Well, let's say we have the definition of A adjoin F inverse, and I told you that O spec A, evaluated on these basic open subsets U sub F, should take the value A adjoin F inverse. So to complete the definition of O spec A, I should really tell you, well, first of all, how you could assemble these answers, these A adjoin F inverse, into a pre-sheaf on the on spec A. And then I should tell you why that pre-sheaf satisfies the descent condition that I mentioned earlier to be a sheaf. So I would like to hold off on that. So why is this a pre-sheaf? I would like to use this to motivate the discussion next time of sort of a formalism for doing higher category theory, which really lets you sort of see why these should assemble into a pre-sheaf in a very canonical way. So that's something that I'll talk about next time, along maybe with why is this a sheaf, etc. Let's just grant these things for a moment, and then we have a good notion of spec A and O spec A, where A is an E infinity ring spectrum. And then we can start gluing things together out of those local pieces to get derived schemes in general. Okay. So now, let me say a few words about how you can think about these derived schemes. So first, example. Any ordinary scheme, XOX, is a derived scheme. Actually, technically, this, I should make a small caveat. If you want to view the XOX as a derived scheme in the sense that I defined earlier, you would have to modify the structure sheaf a little bit, namely, if you have a sheaf of ordinary commutative rings and you regard that as a pre-sheaf of E infinity rings, which happen to be discrete, well, it might no longer satisfy the descent condition. So you would have to sheafify it. But that sheafification process doesn't really do anything. It doesn't change the values on any of the affine opens. So I'm just going to ignore that point. Any ordinary scheme can be regarded as a derived scheme. And the reason, again, is that any ordinary commutative ring can be regarded as an E infinity ring, an E infinity ring which has no non-zero homotopy groups. Now, there's sort of a counterpart to this. any derived scheme, XOX determines an ordinary scheme. Namely, take the same topological space, X, and then take the structure sheaf and apply the functor pi naught everywhere. And now, again, to be precise, when you apply pi naught everywhere, you only get a pre-sheaf of commutative rings. You would then have to sheafify, but that sheafification procedure doesn't really do anything. It doesn't change the values on affine open subsets. So any derived scheme determines an ordinary scheme, and that's an inverse to this construction. Now, how are you supposed to think about this? Well, suppose we work only with connective E infinity rings. That is, we don't allow negative homotopy groups. Well, then, for any E infinity ring A, there's a canonical map from A to the discrete E infinity ring pi naught of A. That map, roughly speaking, is just given by taking, we think of A as a space with the structure of a commutative ring, and we collapse all of its path components to points. So this translates to a map from spec pi naught of A into spec of A. And more generally, if we were to do this not in the affine case, but with a general derived scheme, we get a map from the pair x pi naught ox to x ox. So if you have one of these derived schemes and it's built out of connective E infinity rings, well, you can make an ordinary scheme out of it, and that ordinary scheme maps back in to this derived scheme. So how should you think about that map? So let me just abbreviate this XOX. Let me just call it X, or how about a script X? Here's script X, and this will be script X ord for ordinary scheme. And now you can think of say X ord as the maximal ordinary subscheme of X. It has a certain universal property, namely it's an ordinary scheme which maps to X, and any other ordinary scheme that maps to X factors uniquely through it. And now, just an analogy that you should keep in mind is that the relationship between derived schemes and ordinary schemes should be thought of as analogous to the relationship between ordinary schemes and reduced schemes. So this map from X ord into X should be thought of under this analogy as being like, if you have an ordinary scheme, you can give it the reduced structure by dividing out by all of the nilpotents in its structure sheaf, and then you construct a sort of maximal reduced subscheme of X. This is sort of analogous to that, and so here these sort of discrete rings, or discrete E-infinity rings, are in some sense analogous to reduced commutative rings. There's rings which contain no nilpotent elements, and these higher homotopy groups, the thing that prevent you from being discrete, these are analogous to nilpotent elements, the things that prevent you from being reduced. So this is a very useful analogy, and it's more than just an analogy. There's some precise sense that you can get out of this, and we'll come back to that when we talk about the deformation theory of derived schemes. All right, so I think I have time to say one more thing today. Well, actually, it might take a little longer than I'm thinking. Why don't I stop there, unless somebody has some questions?